and they zoom in on Goldie Hawn lifting her high heel away from the puddle. The gayest moment in 90s cinema, as far as I'm concerned. Welcome back to another episode of Replaying Favorites. It's the show where we cheat death in every movie from the early 1990s. I'm Chris Kelly.
I'm Bree Callahan.
That was a weird intro, and that's not what this podcast is about, but it is what it is about this week because we're watching Death Becomes Her. Bree, what do you know about Death Becomes Her?
Well, we established last week that I have conflated this movie with She-Devil. I am pleased to know, however, that both of them star Meryl Streep, so like, my brain is not completely broken, though it is mostly broken. Other than that, I know nothing. I think this is like one of those movies like The Witches of Eastwick, where it's like a group of spooky women, and there's also a man involved, and hijinks.
You're not miles off. I think elements of this movie are bound to surprise you, but hopefully some of them are bound to delight you.
Oh, I assume that's true. I like Goldie Hawn a lot.
She does excellent work here. I think much of the cast is doing great. I wouldn't call this a perfect movie by any stretch, but I really look forward to hearing your thoughts on many aspects of it.
I feel like I've seen the extreme end of the movie where maybe it's just like two heads talking to each other.
I cannot confirm or deny the presence of two heads in this film.
What the fuck? Are you a PIO for like the Defense Department?
I'm just against spoilers. I want you to go in as fresh as you can. I don't know why I'm a stickler about that, but we're going to get into a lot of movies that you've seen once or twice, or movies that I've only seen once or twice. And I feel like while we've got the pure distillation of what this podcast is about, we should cling to it and treasure it.
Like our heads. Great. Well, I will look forward to watching it.
Excellent transition. And we're off to the break. We're back from break, and we have watched Death Becomes Her, a 1992 comedy directed by Robert Zemeckis, co-written by David Koepp, who also was a co-writer on Jurassic Park, which is how I got inspired to make this choice. I know, strange. And Martin Donovan, who is not involved with Jurassic Park. This movie won an Academy Award for Best Visual Effects. It opened number one at the box office its first weekend. It had a budget of $55 million and made $149 million. Opened to mixed reviews, but is now a queer cult classic. It stars Meryl Streep as Madeline Ashton, Goldie Hawn as Helen Sharp, Bruce Willis as Dr. Ernest Menville, and Isabella Rossellini as Liesl von Rumen. This is the story of two frenemies who both take a potion that makes them immortal while fighting over a man and how to take care of their bodies after death. It's a really convoluted story, much more so than I remembered, in fact. Bree, what did you think of this movie?
We're gonna fight. I really didn't like it.
No, I think that's okay. I recognize that this is a tough pill to swallow. This is one of the weirder ones, and I am never surprised when it's not someone else's favorite.
So I'm afraid that you're going to accuse me of just being super straight again, because I do know that it's like a queer camp classic. But I somehow had in my head, and I might be thinking about a different movie, that it was going to be like Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep like one-upping each other and like killing each other in like new and interesting ways. And I was just so disappointed that they were like basically fighting over Bruce Willis.
I think people remember this as a camp classic because there are moments in it that are very good. But I don't know that a lot of people watch this whole movie all the way through when they think about how much they love it. I think this is a movie best seen in like YouTube clips.
Yeah, like I would watch 3 to 5 YouTube clips of this movie again because there were moments that I really enjoyed. But it made me really sad. So I know that we're supposed to be kind of into them because they're like these two wicked ladies who defy the system and like play by their own rules and like defy death and all this stuff. But it just made me feel really bad that like at the end of the movie, they are as consumed, if not more consumed, with keeping up their appearance, and they don't actually seem to get to do anything fun or cool. They're just constantly doing upkeep on their bodies, and it made me really sad.
So a key thing to know about the production of this movie is that it started off as a much darker concept. So Robert Zemeckis, while he was making this, or at least directly before he was making this, was making Tales from the Crypt. And one of the critiques often leveled against this movie is that it is an extended Tales from the Crypt episode that has, like, some brassy lady performances thrown in for fun. But it is mostly a story about, like, the monkey's paw of wishing for an eternal life and an eternal beauty and instead getting the shitty end of that stick. And it's the kind of thing that would work in, like, a 45-minute episode of, like, Spooky Stories.
Yeah, I guess I can also see in there's like an inherent critique of Hollywood and the way that women's bodies are treated. And then it felt bad for them to get like the monkey's paw end of the stick when they're still like caught up in that same hamster wheel. And the fact that they were fighting over Bruce Willis, who was doing like an extended Rick Moranis impression for like the back hour of the movie, beggared belief.
The movie did a lot of rewriting in terms of the ending, too. It had, like, three different endings at three different points. I don't know that they have a thesis statement by the end of this script. It definitely feels like they had a good idea to start with and did not know where it was going.
Yeah, I think that's what it is that, like, I can feel the implicit critique of Hollywood and material culture and how women are asked to perform in this way that straight men are not. And then it just felt like it totally fluffed the landing. Like, it just felt like the men who were writing this didn't know what that would bring upon their two women leads.
I think that's right. There's also a really interesting wrinkle that if you watch the trailer for this movie, there was a third large female character of Tracy Ullman, who was entirely cut.
After they released the trailer? Fascinating.
Tracy Ullman was to be a third love interest for Bruce Willis, who he runs away with and fakes his own death to get out of the clutches of Madeline and Helen.
See, I just feel like we spent altogether too much time being interested in Bruce Willis, full stop. The only thing he seemed to bring to any relationship was money. He certainly didn't bring dynamism or sexual interest or anything else. Like, he's such a goof, and he's drunk himself to an early grave for reasons that are completely unclear. I guess it's because he and Madeline drive each other crazy. I don't know. I can't believe there was supposed to be a third woman obsessed with him. Like, I would have really loved this movie if it had just been like these two women who are frenemies and they just fuck each other up because they can't kill each other, like, over and over again. But the part in which it related to Bruce Willis's character in particular was so, so boring to me. There is a camp movie that I like love in here, and I just didn't actually find it when I watched it.
It did stretch one's belief that Meryl Streep would not just steal this person, but marry him. Like, that Madeline would steal Helen's soon-to-be husband is something I can get behind, but that she would marry him and stay married just for a 10-year-long fuck you revenge feels really not satisfying to the plot. Even I like your version better, where the two of them are going at it and Bruce Willis
isn't in it. It also is just such a strange let me also step back and say that, like, I was really disappointed by the continual plot that we see in 80s and early 90s movies, which is that, like, a character got super fat and disgusting and therefore she's a fat and disgusting person. But, like, I don't understand also why they're frenemies. Like, we don't really see the instigating incident, which actually appears to be later in the film when Meryl Streep talks about the fact that she always felt like Goldie Hawn looked down on her for being lower class than she was. But we never see why they don't like each other, aside from the fact that Madeline is continually stealing Helen's men, but also, like, girl, just go find another man. And this time, don't go to her show. Problem solved. Like, never see her again, and you have solved all of your problems.
That scene where they do the reveal of what the instigating incident was is really dissatisfying to me, because it takes all of a minute to go through all of their backstory and to then completely erase it.
Yeah. Like, why didn't they just have this conversation years ago? Like, or why haven't they stopped being friends? Again, a real easy way to excise someone toxic from your life is to just never see them again, not to buy tickets to their Broadway play.
Their bad Broadway play.
Okay, can we talk about So I don't want to like just come down on this movie like it was the worst thing I've ever seen. I didn't like it and I won't watch it again, but I did have a note that says, when is a bad musical bad and when is it just actually bad? I appreciate what they're doing, but this is a little tiresome. And then I said, never mind, they just got to the disco and it transcended.
Yeah, I think they go all in on making it terrible. There's something specifically dopey about Meryl Streep's face on the playbill that is perfect. She has like a blank expression that really captures like, oh, no one knew what they were doing at any point in this musical.
Yeah, it's very true. It's fun. I really like getting to see Meryl Streep be funny because she's a very good comedic actor. And I feel like the culture has gotten so tied up in her being like this insane dramatic actor who like has to be in every movie that we've really lost a lot of her extremely camp sensibility.
She nails this role. I think she's well used when she's not just funny, but kind of mean. Like, I think we're very used to her being a dramatic saint. And I think that she's just, you know,
she's got a bitch face and she knows how to use it in this movie.
I was about to say, I don't necessarily love when Hollywood just writes like that old bitch movies, but no one's a better old bitch than Meryl Streep.
Yeah, I have another note that says I've never seen The Devil Wears Prada, but I have to imagine it is this level of her just having a good time playing a stuffy ass bitch. And that's okay. Lean into it.
It's interesting to note that while it looks like she's having a good time, she disliked making a great deal of this movie because of the special effects involved. So like the scene where her head's on backwards, she had to film her head somewhere else in a different day, and then on set just has like a bag over her head so that they can capture her body. And she said that it was a really unpleasant time to make the film, and she doesn't do special effects movies basically at all anymore, specifically because of this.
She seems like an actor who acts because she likes to interact with other actors and play off them. So I can definitely see how that's the case. It is interesting watching her just like totally outstrip Bruce Willis as an actor. Like, he's great. I mean, he's a very good actor and he's very funny. I don't think he's particularly funny in this. I found him very tiresome. But Streep is just such a good actor. And the movie really starts popping when you actually get to see Goldie Hawn and Streep play off each other, because it's very fun. But unfortunately, that doesn't happen until like the last 20 minutes of the movie. So there's like an hour 40 where you're just like,
There are a lot of pacing issues with this movie. We are over 30 minutes in before the main plot device gets revealed.
It's an hour before she falls down the stairs. It's fully halfway through the film before it's even clear that she's dead.
So they had a lot of pacing problems to deal with. In addition to Meryl Streep doing an excellent job, I think this might be Goldie Hawn's best performance. I love her in this role.
Yeah, she's very good. She's very funny. I don't think that I have a ton of things to compare it to, because I have seen her in Overboard, and I can't think what else I've seen her in, to be perfectly honest. I mean, like old Laugh-In stuff, but the most striking thing to me was how much she looks like her daughter. Like the pictures in particular, like Kate Hudson, they look exactly alike.
So we talked about Bruce Willis maybe not being 100% suited for this role. It will interest you to know, this was initially a Kevin Kline role. He dropped out.
Oh, he would have been perfect in this. He's got that elasticity in his body, and he's just more loose as an actor than Bruce Willis is. I don't want to say that I don't think Bruce Willis is a fine comedic actor, because I think that he is very funny, but he was coming off like moonlighting in this kind of roguish, sarcasmo sort of a dude. He was just ill cast. Like, I just didn't understand why either of these women would be interested in him, full stop.
Yeah, I credit him for trying very hard. He's clearly putting a lot of energy in, but it maybe shouldn't be clear how much energy he's putting in.
It's a very high octane performance, and I think that it would have been better if he had dialed it back to an 8 instead of a 14.
Yeah. The other, not really lead in this movie, but there aren't that many characters, is Isabella Rossellini, who, oh my God.
I'm warm all over.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Has anyone ever looked or been better in a film?
I don't think so. She is luminous. She is gorgeous. She's sensual. She says every word perfectly. I think we can all die happy having seen Isabella Rossellini do this.
And again, here's another perfect example of a comedic actor who is so underused for their comedy. You see her again in 30 Rock, where she gets to be amusing when she plays Jack Donaghy's ex-wife or soon-to-be ex-wife. But I've never gotten to see her do anything else funny. So when she turned up on 30 Rock, I was like, I didn't know Isabella Rossellini was like real funny. But yeah, she's hilarious in this movie. I have no notes for her performance whatsoever.
Yeah. So I am going to play this game with you now. Meryl Streep is asked to guess Isabella Rossellini's age. How old do you think Isabella Rossellini was when she made this movie?
32.
39.
I'm extremely angry with myself for letting myself go.
I don't think anyone should be expected to look like Isabella Rossellini looks, but yeah, I love that Meryl Streep guesses 38 and Isabella Rossellini shoots her the world's dirtiest look, but she is in fact a year older than that.
We might need to like pause while I gather myself and find a vial of elixir so that I can de-age myself. That bitch is my age in this. I can't.
Yeah. Also, they do a lot of talk about age in this movie. Meryl Streep is 42 in this role. Goldie Hawn is 46.
Yeah, the only thing that I know is that Goldie Hawn was already in her 40s when she did Overboard. So the fact that both of these women are actually in their mid-40s at this time is like, I mean, they look great. Like, that's what's kind of irritating about the film is that they're just like, isn't the worst thing in the world for a woman to be approaching 50? And I'm like, well, those bitches are in their mid-40s and they look great. They'll be fine in 7 years. The movie acts like 7 years is like the worst thing that can happen to a woman.
I know. Like, they make a point at the book release of saying that Goldie Hawn's character is 50 and the only way she could look that good is with a magic potion. And I'm like, Goldie Hawn is 4 years younger than that and looks incredible because she's Goldie Hawn.
Yeah, you've restored Goldie Hawn to looking like Goldie Hawn, and that's how we got to 50. it's not that difficult. It's also just that, like, as a culture, people don't age the same as they used to. Like, the difference between 43 in 1970 and 43 today is like super different. And also, I think like the expectations of how someone would look are really different. Like, I think now people expect people to look like Isabella Rossellini because you got Meryl Streep out here at what, like almost 70 now? And she like still looks like she's in her 40s.
It's really interesting to now look at Meryl Streep, how she looks, to show how good the age makeup was in this movie. Like, they predicted the future Meryl Streep very well.
I mean, they predicted 30 years later Meryl Streep, like not 7 years later Meryl Streep. But yes, I mean, they did do a good job of showing how she would eventually look.
And I don't want to pretend like I'm unaware of the possibility of plastic surgery and injectables. I'm not going to assume who's had what. But I know that celebrities have access to things that make them age more slowly, and I'll just leave it at that.
This movie also presumes a world in which Bruce Willis's hair, like, extended another 7 years, which it clearly did not. Oh my God, so wait, so he's...
Bruce Willis is only 36 when this movie is made.
Whoa! So he's, like, way younger than these two. So he's a decade younger than Goldie Hawn. Wow. Fascinating. Okay, so that is actually kind of some really hardcore feminist casting. You never see two women cast against the romantic male lead who is a decade younger than them. I'm just thinking about him being in The Fifth Element 5 years after this and somehow looking younger. I mean, obviously they're doing a lot of like age and drinking makeup on him. I mean, he looks rough, but I guess what I'm trying to say about like the whole age problem, if you will, is that like, I don't think anyone today views 50 in the way that it was viewed in the late 80s and early 90s. Like, being 50 then was like a death sentence. And now it's just like, oh, you're 50. You're close to continuing to never retire because none of us ever will.
My expectation would have been that they would have cast actresses in their early 30s. And so I was pleased to see that they had people who were age appropriate and just happened to look amazing, even if they are the whole time being like, you look great, you hag.
And to be honest, before I put some thought into it, I did think that both of those actors were younger. I assumed that they were in their late 30s. That was also part of it, is I was just like, there's something so sad to me about a woman looking in the mirror and just being like terrified by herself. That happened multiple times, especially Streep in the car, like literally almost driving off the road because she was so like terrified by the visage of her own face. That, I don't, like I said, it just made me sad.
Yeah. I mean, we can't all see Isabella Rossellini when we look in the mirror. God damn it, is she the greatest thing to ever happen to cinema.
I like how we are actually falling into the trap of the movie, which is that like women are appealing based on a certain set of criteria, but damn, she checks all those boxes. Like she just looks, don't get me wrong, all three of those women look stunning. Like when they do the special effect of like Meryl's body like coming back into shape, they're just putting it back into Meryl's actual body.
I feel like getting into the plot of this movie is almost secondary, but Meryl Streep marries Bruce Willis. I think the timing on that reveal is really funny, of like Goldie Hawn is like, just don't let her get to you. And they smash cut to the wedding. And I was like, that's camp.
Au contraire. The actual line is, do you know how silly you're sounding, from Bruce Willis, followed by the smash cut? Because I wrote down that exact line and then wrote, this is why straight women hate all straight men.
Yeah.
But yes, I did also write the smash cut and put it in bold so that I made sure we talked about it, because it is a fabulous smash cut.
See, I think if the movie had leaned more into that sensibility, it would be better. I don't think this movie quite understood how silly it could become. I think maybe it needed more women and gay men backstage to help with that, but it has flashes of brilliance.
And the other thing that I think is really missing from this movie, which is surprising to me because, and I'll put my cards on the table here for a future episode, Robert Zemeckis directed one of my favorite movies, which is Back to the Future, which I think has one of the greatest set pieces, are they going to get it done, tension, action sequences, you know, like when they got to get the lightning to strike the building in order for Marty to get back to the future. And every piece of that is so like tension filled and so specific, and you know where all the pieces are. And I'm going to jump all the way to the end here, which is that like when Bruce Willis is hanging out over the kind of the exact same thing where like lightning striking, you know, there's a rainstorm and Bruce Willis is hanging out over the courtyard, and is he or is he not going to die? I was just like, can we get this over with? Because like, it's obvious what's going to happen. Like, it didn't feel like this movie had any tension, and it just felt like it was just missing a really substantial piece that could have made it great. And I don't know exactly what that alchemy was, but it just didn't quite have it.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of good ideas in here, but they are not strung together by a coherent plot by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
I was even surprised rewatching it this time. I'm just so predisposed to forgetting all of the slow points, and I think I just black out all the parts that don't matter, which is a good 50% of the parts.
Like I said, you have to get through 50% of the movie before anything fun happens. I mean, Isabella Rossellini has been in there for like a minute, but there's so much setup, and the setup is real fucking basic. Two women take a potion. Now they're immortal.
Yeah, it's funny. I think that they think they're devoting a lot of time to the quote-unquote important backstory of Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn's relationship, but there's not a lot of information about the relationship.
Yeah, we're just like, they hate each other, but they also can't leave each other. I'm like, well, why? Like, we understand what pushes them apart, but we don't understand why they are so obsessed with each other. Like, why does Goldie Hawn have to go to a mental institution? Why? Well, A, why is Goldie Hawn arrested for being evicted? Because I don't think that's what happens. And B, why does she go to a mental institution where they're just obsessed with her losing weight?
I was furious when she opened her cabinet and it's just jars of frosting. I was like, this is the most base level humor about like fat shaming that I've ever seen. Frosting.
that she licks off her fingers while cats mew around her. Like, it was just bad. Like, it wasn't entertaining. There were no sparks of anything interesting in that, in those scenes. It was just like, this lady is awful and bad and fat, and she is disgusting.
This movie should open with the book party. Meryl Streep gets an invite to a book party from a woman she hates, and she looks better than expected. That's all we need.
It's very clear that a man made the choice that the center around which these two women need to revolve is this man. I get that it's kind of interesting that he winds up being a piece of utility for them, that they're not actually interested in him romantically. They want him as, like, a mechanic. But the whole idea that Goldie Hawn would go through all this effort to win back this particular man, I would have been much more interested in her dropping Meryl Streep off the side of a cliff.
And it's funny, too, because there's the potential for a real feminist take. Like, this movie does pass the Bechdel test with flying colors. Most of the leads are women. Most of the conversations are women talking to other women. It just somehow all hinges on this one plastic surgeon that everyone wants to marry and no one seems to like.
Yeah, because he's not interesting. There's nothing interesting in him except for his hands, and then he drinks them away for reasons that are unclear.
There is one other man in this movie who I want to talk about because I think his performance is fucking amazing. Sidney Pollack comes in as an ER doctor.
Oh, bless him.
And gives just one scene that is actually perfect.
100,000 rays of light towards Sidney Pollack for just delivering a pitch perfect performance on a man who is just way out of his depth and needs to go.
I think I don't often think about him in this movie. I think about Meryl Streep. I think about Goldie Hawn. I think about Isabella Rossellini maybe every day. I am always happy to see Sidney Pollack pop up, and I cackled rewatching his scene.
He got a lot of laughs out of me. It was probably a third of the laughs that I had in the film. That's the other problem, is that there are a number of great actors who are working with a substandard script that does not deliver the number of laughs that these actors deserve. There are a couple moments where I laughed out loud, in particular Streep saying, "Now a warning," which is the best line reading she's ever given in her entire career, and I will fight all comers on this. Goldie Hawn is a comedic actor. Like, Bruce Willis, too, is a comic actor, and there was just such potential here, and they just kind of got delivered this script that didn't really, like, harness their comedic talents.
I mean, "Now a warning" is the iconic line from this movie. I'm so glad that you enjoyed it, because that's the only part that I feel emotionally connected to.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, like, what happens in the middle third, I guess. You know, there's some fun physical comedy once we get all three of the main leads together. I do have a note that says we maybe should have spent another hour practicing the sword combat. There's, like, a hold, clang, hold, clang, that I do know that, because I looked this up, is that Meryl accidentally cut Goldie Hawn's face, so I think they might have been a little tentative after that.
It's funny because, on the one hand, that middle section is kind of a mess. The whole plot's a mess. But the middle section is at least really vibrant. It's fun to watch Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn go at it. Like, the core of the movie is letting them fight.
But that's only like 15 minutes of the movie. I don't know how I got it in my head that this was a movie about the two of them fighting for the entire movie. And so I was just expecting, like, more of that section, and it didn't deliver.
Yeah, and I think that's the better movie, though. They sort of yada, yada, yada past what happens between their death and the, like, 40 years later. And that's the movie that we all wanted to watch.
Yeah, what have they been up to in the past 37 years? Did they get to continue to act? Like, did Goldie write another book? Like, all this stuff. The one thing that also made me kind of really sad is that, like, Goldie Hawn's character got 7 years or so in the, like, perfect, great, whatever body. And then Meryl Streep got, like, one day?
Not even. Yeah, she comes home from having drunk the potion, immediately gets in a fight with Bruce Willis, and then is murdered.
Yeah, and then she's just got to deal with this, like, actually decaying, decrepit body for the rest of her life. I just felt bad for her. But, like, Goldie got to, like, run around for 7 years, like, looking amazing. And also, how did Goldie Hawn find Isabella Rossellini? And how did she have the money for this? She got evicted from her last apartment and was at a state-run insane asylum.
That is another yada, yada, yada that this movie does.
I also had a lot of questions at this point for Isabella Rossellini's character. She must have all the money in the world. What is she getting out of this?
So her character was another one that went under a few rewrites. In the first draft of the script, she was apparently actually Cleopatra. That old.
Oh, that's fun.
It's unclear who she is, why she has this potion or how she got it.
How she makes more of it.
What she's doing with the money. All of those questions are unanswered.
And why she's so obsessed with Bruce Willis taking the potion. She's like, do it. But I'm like, for what benefit? He hasn't even given you money.
That's another cut element from the script, which is that it's very important to her that the potion be kept secret. And kind of the only way to do that is once you reveal the potion, you have to make the person drink it and have to bring them into the sort of cult. She does have a motivation that they just didn't bother to explain.
I feel like we could have spent 5 more minutes on that and maybe 5 fewer minutes on eating frosting.
Yeah, they made this movie longer than a TV episode, but did not add more depth than a TV episode. If they had added more comedy, it would have been forgiven. But there's a lot of long stretches that are just plot, even though there's no plot.
Yeah, I've already forgotten more about this movie than we're going to talk about today. If they had gotten to be glamorous and delightful and do their own thing at the end of the movie, I think I would have had far fewer critiques. But the fact that like their entire lives were obsessed with just like they couldn't even be out in public with their faces because they were so decrepit, which is exactly what would have happened if they had just aged.
And that in itself is an insight that I don't even think this script has. I don't even know that there's anything to say about it, but I guess we should talk about that whole weird section where Bruce Willis goes to the mansion to drink the potion while there is a party going on for everyone who has had the potion before. It's a useless mess start to finish.
Absolutely a waste of time. I would have spent the time with Isabella Rossellini learning about her motivations because instead we got fat Elvis, which if you're Elvis and you've taken the potion, why are you skinny Elvis? Why the fuck are you still fat Elvis?
There's a lot of celebrity impersonators in this movie. They clearly didn't have a budget for great ones. But I also love that every celebrity who has faked their death has also decided to dress in a costume of themselves. Like Elvis, who is laying low, is fully in like an Elvis costume. Marilyn Monroe shows up in her Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend pink dress, which is not how you lay low when you're Marilyn Monroe.
What an incredibly silly premise. That was one of my questions about like, what is Isabella Rossellini's motivation? Like, if you've already got the money, why are you spending money on like hors d'oeuvres for these fuckers? There were so many like pieces of the plot that existed, but there was no purpose behind them.
No, that whole party is just so you can be like, I recognize what celebrity that person is playing. Like Jim Morrison shows up by the pool, but it's like, is there a mystery surrounding Jim Morrison's death? Like, is there any question as to whether Jim Morrison is dead? There's a James Dean who might be the best lookalike of the group, but also, no one thought James Dean faked his death. He very died.
I do like that the movie made a point of showing that a number of men had taken the potion as well, so that there is an understanding that these expectations exist for men too, and that they're difficult, though beggar's belief that Jim Morrison was like, me at what, 27 or something, is so terrible looking that I would need to have this potion to live forever and then kill myself. Presumably in that case, Jim Morrison would have taken the potion at 17 because you get to exist. You get to exist in the culture for 10 years and then you have to step out. So let's not dig any more into that.
And on that point, Andy Warhol is at the party, but is not young. It's like older Andy Warhol. I'm like, why did Andy Warhol even take the potion if he's not going to stay young?
Because you wouldn't recognize Andy Warhol otherwise. Like, it's the same reason why it's old fat Elvis, because you wouldn't recognize young Elvis. Though, they really missed an opportunity with the boy from Hairspray. They could have gotten him in that fourth movie.
They should have.
But yeah, you're right. Andy Warhol looking like he did in Basquiat is amazing. Chris, this movie doesn't make any damn sense.
I honestly like your misremembering of the movie better. If this had been like a Tom and Jerry, except that it's Streep and Hahn, and they're just like one-upping each other, that would have been amazing. I would have watched that forever.
I do want to cop to the fact that, like, because I thought that's what this was, I thought that more hijinks were going to ensue than hijinks actually ensued. So, like, I think I set myself up to have this movie be a little bit more entertaining than it ever intended to be. But what a missed opportunity. I will say that I'm glad that this isn't like a Hairspray level movie for you, because I was a little concerned coming into this that I would have somehow like missed the campiest cult classic of all time, and like I just didn't get it. And I was just like, I feel like I got it, and it was sad making.
This movie makes no sense. It has no plot. There's none. There, like, I mean, it has a lot of plot, but it all adds up to literally nothing because it doesn't know what it's saying.
I think that this movie would be absolutely ripe for a remake that totally re-envisions the plot that potentially casts Kate Hudson. I'm not sure if she's got the chops for it, but it would be a fun stunt casting. It just needs to come at this basic premise of these two villainous women that have access to a potion of immortality and take in a totally different direction. Because I gotta tell you, I was really uninterested in this direction. I think this is my least favorite film that we've watched.
Oh, wow. Oh, no. This is your Better Off Dead.
It is not my Better Off Dead. I didn't hate it with the fiery sun that you brought to Better Off Dead, but I'm never watching this movie again.
That's okay. I actually don't know that I could recommend watching this whole movie multiple times. I think it's worth it to catch the good parts, but it is not overall a good movie. I can't argue that in good faith. That's a lie.
I am so relieved. I was actually having like anxiety about this episode because I was really afraid that another noted was coming for me. But instead, I feel like I got to deliver the noted and I feel good about that.
I was very glad, bordering on needing you to like Now a Warning.
Oh,
as long
God.
As we have that to hang the tent on, the rest of it doesn't matter.
Chris, I'm not a monster. Now a Warning is one of the best line deliveries in the history of cinema. Well, this was your movie. Any final thoughts on Death Becomes Her?
No, I've said everything I need to say. I think that everyone should see it once and find their favorite moments and treasure those and never watch the whole movie again, probably. But I'm gay and I'm a sucker for sassy broads.
I'm also a sucker for sassy broads, and I wish they'd been treated with slightly more respect. This isn't something I watch again, but I think I will seek out clips on YouTube because I am sure that the moments that I enjoyed have all been clipped. And the moments that I didn't enjoy will fade into the ether.
Oh, thank goodness for the modern era where we can just watch the best 10 minutes of any movie. If you want more than the best 10 minutes of us, we have social media. We are at Replaying Favorites on Instagram and at Replaying Faves, F-A-V-S, on Twitter. We are a podcast, which means you can subscribe to us. You can rate us 5 stars. You can leave a review. It helps us when you do those things because then more people listen to us. And that's good for my ego.
Oh, and mine.
So please do that. But now we're going to move on to another film. Bree, what have you chosen?
So I don't know if I'm ready to do this, but for some reason, my heart is just speaking it. I'll put it this way. I'm glad we aligned on our feelings about this film because I was a little afraid to assign a movie that I love more than my life itself to you after maybe shitting on Death Becomes Her. But I can't. I looked through the list today and my heart is just singing out for Disney's Robin Hood.
Oh, great.
So just to let the listeners know, we're recording this just several days before the inauguration. We don't know what's going to happen. I'm a mess, and I think I need a British fox to just make my heart feel a sense of comfort and joy and love. And so we're going to watch that fox and Little John, who is a bear.
I cannot wait.
So you've never seen Disney's Robin Hood?
Literally never. I have seen maybe small clips of it because I've seen the animation from it. I can picture some of the characters, but not all the way through or even longer than a 2-second chunk.
So how can I prepare you for this? I want to be very clear that I'm like close to tears even assigning this to you for the thought that you might not love it, because it is like the formulative film of my entire childhood and early adulthood. So be forewarned, this is the shit, man. Like, this movie is perhaps perfect.
Okay, I will take that note as I watch it and I will bring it to the discussion.
I cannot wait for you to watch this. I hope you feel about it the same way I do. I'm certain there are flaws, even though I just said there were no flaws, and we'll discuss them at length. But for now, we will see you guys next week.
Bye.
I don't want to cast straight dispersions on somebody if they are, in fact, gay.